study that kind of wondering, you know, the rights. About something, it was interesting. That J2 rigid mass injector broke with a kitten. Yeah, bad that F1. That was a terror.
Well, what would you say then was the final fix, the injector baffles?
That was just one step. It took about three or four major steps to solve the problem. First, we put on the baffles.
Yeah.
And the next step we did was we slowed down the burning rate in the first few inches of the injection process. And we had a locked like-on-like and a pure like-on-like. Mm-hmm. And we went to a smaller inclusive angle so that we spread the fuel out. And you know, if this is the combustion process down here, the fuel was on about a, say, a 90 degree. I don't know if that's quite what it was, maybe 70.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, our barnyard philosophy told us that if were we to slow down the burning process, that we might desensitize the injection process so that when these waves came back, it wasn't, you weren't really in the critical process up near the injector face. So we decreased that angle, spread out the burning time. That was the second major step. The third step was that we found that we wanted to change the response time between the locks and the fuel system. And we opened up the diameter of the fuel holes so that when you perturbate the system, the lock system would recover quickly. It was stiff. But the fuel system would recover at a slower rate because it was soft.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you want to do. You want to have them recover at different frequencies. Because if they're recovering at the same frequency, you're putting out a lot of energy. Whereas if they're recovering at different frequencies, you're damping the process. So that was the third step.
So you opened the diameter of the fuel hole.
That's right.
In the face of the injector.
That's right.
Okay.
And then the fourth step was that we went and around the edges of the baffles where we knew that there were accumulations of fuel, we modified the injection patterns to try and eliminate these fuel accumulations, because if you got a fuel accumulation there, then it's a source of explosion, you know, and perturbating perturbation source, a triggering device, if you want to call it that. So that was the way that the thing went. I recall one time when Brandon Holmes was running the Saturn program, he called some of us up to Washington into his office, and he was so concerned about this problem that we weren't able to solve. And he told us all that he was ready to go to Congress and tell them that we wanted to have a backup propulsion system for the S1C, and he was prepared to go and ask for a solid motors for the backup. And he went around the room and he asked those of us that were there what our own personal feelings were about whether or not we were going to solve this problem. And, it's pretty dramatic. He was a top man saying that he was ready to go ask Congress for a backup if we told him that we couldn't solve the problem, or if we told him we might not solve the problem. He says, I want you to tell me truthfully how you feel. So everybody, I guess a few of us expressed ourselves, and he says, well, he says, I'm going to take your advice. And he says, we'll continue the program, assuming that we can solve the problem. Fortunately, we did. But it really, really something that always sticks in my memory.
Was Von Braun involved in any of this?
Nope, he sure was.
Yeah.
It was Herman Widener, who was up there with it was Herman Widener, myself, and the man who was project manager at that time. Sonny Moran.
Oh, yeah.
But I was the chairman of this ad hoc committee to solve this problem. And that was the reason that I was there. The other man was there from Rockman, or two men from there from Rockman, was Paul Cassinghold. And their vice president, Joe McNamara.
Do you have any papers or reports, AIAA things that help summarize this? I've seen some documents we have, but I can't think of any really specific documents at this time that we've got.
The only thing I have ever done is I've written minutes of all the meetings that were held with this small working group to solve the problem. I have, but I've never published any papers on it, and I don't think any of those that were key in the solution ever published any papers either.
Yeah.
But I've seen a whole bunch of papers by people who were not directly involved, but expanded on how the thing was solved.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are far from the way it actually was.
Would it be possible to get a look at those minutes? Okay.
Not that far. I think that they were classified at that time, but they're, I'm sure, decent.
Yeah.
Hey, Phil, don't we have the old ad hoc committee file on the F1? In that red? Yeah?
I'll tell you what I could do is, if you don't mind, I can take it over the historical office over here, Aiken's office in 4200,
mm-hmm.
and work on them there and leave them there. And
mm-hmm.
when I'm done and when I'm finished with them all, I can bring them back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be acceptable?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's the only record that exists as far as what took place. And I saved it all these years. But one of the days I figured I'd write how it really was.
Yeah, I wish you would. I got to do that. Well, I really feel guilty. I'm keeping you from this meeting.
I know they're not getting too far on solid motor materials. We don't know what it looked like yet.
Do you have anything else you'd like to throw
in? Let
me
ask you, what are your objectives in this? Is to dish out significant happenings during the course of the Saturn program? Or are you just going to simply cover the whole waterfront?
Well, I'd have to say yes to both of those. In a way, we're trying to cover as much as we can along the waterfront. And
I think there's a whole series of folders on it. Yeah, how many is it?
As time goes along, we find certain things, and we've got an opportunity to do it, to dig down, here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends kind of on what we stumble across, either in the documents or an interview like this,
yeah,
as to what we can maybe go into in more detail. But
the reason I was asking, I do a little writing myself. ESI line, the augmented spark igniter.
Yeah, I've talked to Jerry Pease about that.
Who?
Jerry P. Or Bob P.
Yeah.
Bob P.
Mm-hmm.
And what really strikes me is that for all the vacuum tests, et cetera, that were supposedly done on the J2 up to that time,
yeah,
why that still happened.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, was because the environment of the vacuum chamber, and I've forgotten what he told me now, was different just enough so that it allowed some of this moisture to collect. And when they finally purged the environmental chamber down to really cold, hard vacuum, and found out what the problem really was.
had to be not only not only did we have to understand what failed, we had to understand how it had failed and why it had failed. And then we had a fourth requirement, and that was to reproduce the activity of the process here on the ground. And in about 4 months period, we went through all four of those things. And I happened to have been the chairman of that investigation.
I didn't know that either.
When you told me you talked about peas, I was kind of wondering about that, because...
You know, some of this stuff, we're rewriting a lot of this stuff. And I've gotten off engines now. I'm into logistics recently.
Yeah.
And I've kind of forgotten, really, since I haven't written up that interview yet, what we really got into now.
Mm-hmm.
As I think about it, I think that maybe he did, you know, mention your name and several others. Wasn't Sonny Moran on that one, too?
No.
Or was that the F1? Maybe
Sonny was the project manager of the J2 at that time.
Yeah, well, maybe that's, he just mentioned him in that context. Then.
But we had about a 200-man activity going in NASA and industry combined. And we had a test stand going out at Rocketdyne, firing engines to try to recreate the problem, testing components and so forth. But Rex Bailey, who works over in the propulsion division, and Carl Heinberg set up a thrust chamber over here in Bill Grafton's test stand. And that's where we recreated the failure, was over there.
Okay, so right over here was really the critical discovery point then.
Yeah.
Out here on this test stand.
Yeah. Sure was. We recreated the failure. As a matter of fact, I had a thing on the wall, but that thing right there, we simulated the failure right over here. We fired about 8 o'clock one night.
Well, now, did you have a vacuum condition out there?
No, because it wasn't necessary to have a vacuum to recreate the process that, you know, where the engine progressed to the point where it quit running.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first of all, you had to create a vacuum here in the outside of this line so that there was no moisture condensation taking place. And then this line would fail due to convolution fatigue. These convolutions there, you know, failed in the crowns due to fatigue, and a crack opened up, and then the hydrogen shot out this way instead of going into the igniter.
Mm-hmm.
And when that hydrogen didn't go into the igniter, then the face of the injector was undercooled, and it got a hot spot on it, and then, you know, like a blowtorch, it just started to consuming itself, and the failure worked back until the injector face just sort of caved in. Well, it's that part of the recreating of the series of circumstances that we performed over here. It was Rocketdyne who, during the course of the investigation, stumbled across the fact that the environment was very important in terms of life of this convolution here.
Okay, so let me try and get this straight then. Rocketdyne first discovered the environmental factor.
That's right.
Okay, and then you recreated the environmental factor out here?
Well, we recreated the failure process.
Okay.
You know, go back first. General Phillips says, he says, you gotta prove what happened. And so we showed him this happened. That line failed.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, how did it fail? It failed due to fatigue. And he says, why did it fail? It failed because of the environment around there. It caused high frequency vibrations and fatigue. And then he says, now you recreate the events like that engine saw in flight. Well, it's that fourth thing that we did over here.
Mm-hmm.
The Rocketdyne stumbled across the fact that the environment was critical to to the fatigue life of those fellows. And that 200 man operation was, like I say, active for about 4 months, and we got the solution.
That was both Marshall and Rocketdyne, the 200 man crew.
Yeah, it was Marshall, Rocketdyne, North American, and Douglas. All four combined effort was 200 men.
Sounds like if you're, you know, getting to the stage of another crunch, like Brainerd Holmes might have called you back up again for another session. Of course,
well,
it was a little late then.
Well, we had something nearly like that, because during the course of that 4 months, we had these things called, I've forgotten what to do now, but it was the Boeing building down in the research park. They had a room that you go in and sit down, and TV shows all over the country to other groups. So we'd have to go down there about once every 3 weeks or something and give a briefing on where we were in this investigation. And that darn thing, I don't know, I mean, it must have been 1,000 people on that hookup. So they had people at Boeing Seattle, people at out on the west coast of Los Angeles, looked into that, people down at KSC, people in Houston, people in Washington. So it was like a Walter Cronkite's news broadcast.
Well, why did they have such an extensive hookup? Was it just to let other people know in terms of their own scheduling, or because of the inputs they could make from a technical standpoint?
No, it was a management review, and all the management, you know, was critically concerned, or very concerned, because we were trying to, you know, go man fly 504.
Yeah, 503, wasn't it?
504.
Okay.
We were trying to go man fly on 504, and 502 had messed up. And They were kind of wondering whether to delay the flight of 503 until we had absolutely proven the solution. And if they delayed 503, they'd delay 504 and then delayed the whole lunar program. So that's why all them people were interested. But it was on that same flight, if you recall, we had the first Pogo problem on the S1C.
On 502, yeah.
So we had Eric Garner, was in charge of the Pogo investigation. And he had a whole team all over the country, and I had this ASI line investigation.
How do you spell it? G-O-E-R-N-E-R, Garner?
G-O-E-R-N-E-R.
Yeah.
Eric Garner.
Yeah, I think it was 503 was the first manned flight. That was Apollo 8.
I didn't know it was.
Yeah, 504 was a manned suborbital flight. 505 went back to the moon, and 506 then was the moon landing.
Well, if it was, then the whole bet was, do we dare
put
men on the bird, lost three engines at Pogo on 502?
Yeah.
That's why they were all sweating.
Were you sweating when that manned launch finally came then? Or were you pretty sure that it was going to go?
Yeah, I sweated every time it flew. Hoping nothing happened. Propulsion system.
As far as the Saturn V mission, that was the only really big problem that you had that was on 502, as I recall. The Pogo and the ASI line.
That's right.
Both happened at the same time.
And of course, those all fell heavily in the propulsion area, so we had plenty of activity. Pogo problem, you know, goes back to what the F1 compliances are and the F1 engine gains. And we had a program going over here now today to run the F1 turbo pumps and engines and get these gain factors. All that's going on here, we're looking at the ASI line phase parallel. Really exciting.
Yeah.
That's the part that really, I think, people would enjoy reading more about if I were looking into the Saturn program. I mean, it's great to read about how you land on the moon, you know, and then the chariots running around all over, but good Lord, they got miles and miles of film about that. But the thing is, isn't really documented is all of the daily excitements and things that went on during the course of getting there.
That's what struck me about writing this history, is that the man part of the mission is so visible. It's easier to relate to me because there are men in it. But the development of the Saturn V and all the testing, static tests and dynamic tests and systems tests and so on, you know, which is such a huge part of the program, and it was basically unknown. I mean, I take visitors out here to the Space Center and they didn't realize that the Saturn I and 1B were a bunch of redstone and Jupiter tanks, you know, hung together. And a lot of people just really don't know that much about the Saturn story itself.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. And I think I hope we can do a fairly good job with it.
Yeah. I remember another one that was real interesting too. One time we were concerned about the H1 engine and its dynamic stability perturbation, you know. We've been running tests up at Joplin, Missouri.
Neosho. Yeah.
Try to bomb the H1 engine and determine whether it was truly dynamically stable and everything. And the engine wouldn't redamp in the time that we had laid down for ourselves that it should. So we began to wonder if the test van up there may have contributed, you know, to the lack of damp time, lack of a desired damp time. So we, Bob Richmond and myself, was working in the area there. We decided that, by golly, the only way you'll ever find out is to put the engine in the stage and then bomb the whole dang stage. And we had a AM-11. That vehicle hasn't even flown a day. It's an S1 stage. We had it over there on test and we had 8 engines in it. It was ready for its acceptance test. And I made the proposal that we put bombs in there, and during the course of the acceptance firing, we'd get data on the stability characteristics of the vehicle as well, and it'd be a real live flight vehicle, and it ought to be surely good. So we put bombs in 4 engines. We ran the stage one time, and we had said we wanted three tests, you know, three burns, and we'd bomb every time. But fired the first time, we bombed four engines and watched the damp characteristics. That was good. So the second time, we bombed 4 engines, and we blew one engine flat out of that stage over there, and it was on the day before George Washington's birthday, a year, two, three, 4 years, 5 years ago. And boy, you're talking about a bunch of sick people. So the next day was George Washington's birthday and holiday, you know. But I was over there crawling around, and that burned up back end, you know, where that engine had burned out. Dan Driscoll was in there, and Carl Heinberg was in there, and Lucas was in there too. We were all four crawling around up there trying to see what the damage was, see how much delay and how much expense and everything was going to take. And it was that day, George Washington's birthday, that a congressional group was touring here. So, naturally, when they hit town, they won't know what had blown up, because you don't dare let a congressional group go through here having had an explosion without telling them we had one. So, in the late afternoon, about 3 o'clock, we finally got a story good enough, well enough to give, and explain to them what had happened and everything. So, that settled it off. So, we began to clean up a mess. Of course, we had to put in a new engine and replace all the hardware, and Chrysler was under contract with us. They fixed everything back pretty good. But we still had one more test to make, you know, because I wanted 3. Somebody came to me and said, Jerry said, what about it? We're gonna get that 3rd test. I said, not on your life. I got all the experience and all the data that I need.
What stage was this you were testing? It was an S1 stage?
No, it was an S1.
Oh,
S1.
Yeah, okay. An S1 then. Yeah.
With H1 engine. But it was a funny thing, the explosion had not come due to anything having to do with stability characteristics. What had happened is when you perturbate the thrust chamber, you know, it causes a bomb explosion down there, and the flow rates and everything change, and then they have to recover. The LOX pump on one of the engines had a carbon nose ring in it, and when you perturbate the engine, this nose ring naturally reacts, and of course it's going at I think at H1 around 5,000 or 6,000 RPMs, and carbon being a hard material, with each shock wave like that, it cracked. And when that cracked, the oxidizer shot through and came in contact with the fuel drain from the other pump, and that's where the explosion came.
Mm-hmm.
Just pop right open. But we've got some good data from the stage from combustion stability thing. Well, we proved without a doubt that the H1 has the required dynamic stability characteristics. But I never did get that third sample.
Well, I still feel guilty about your meeting up here. I'm afraid I'm keeping you.
This is these reports.